transition from chemical evolution to Darwinian evolution, or sometimes I just use a title like design and synthesis of an artificial cell or protocell. So they're all focused on the same question, which is how, if you have all of the building blocks, how you organize them properly to get something that has the properties of life. Now, if there's time and interest when I'm done going through this, I can also talk about subjects more closely related to what Michael was just saying, which is the use of evolutionary methods in vitro to find new functional molecules, and also to approach something which I think is a very fundamental physical issue, which is the relationship between information content and molecular function. So we can see how things go. Okay, so in terms of thinking about the origin of life or synthetic life in the laboratory, what I'm going to do is start off with a brief introduction, just showing or just talking about how you can take what we know about life and try to reason backwards to earlier, simpler forms of life, and also on the other hand, what we know about chemistry and trying to reason upwards in complexity from that towards what simple systems might look like, and then sort of transition into the experiments that we and others are doing in the lab. Okay, so I'm sure everybody knows that all life on Earth is actually very closely related once you get down to looking at things in the biochemical level. So using a variety of phylogenetic methods, you can organize all living things on this kind of tree structure and find I think not so controversial anymore, a point which represents the point of descent from the last common ancestor. So this is both good and bad, because we can deduce a lot about the structure of that last common ancestor from this kind of information. But it also points out a very big problem in terms of thinking about the origin of life, which is that the last common ancestor of all extant life is actually pretty much like what we have now. And so it doesn't really, it's not very informative in thinking about forms of life that were much simpler and much earlier. Okay, and that problem is illustrated by this kind of diagram of the that shows the fundamental interrelationships or interdependencies of all of the major aspects of central informational metabolism. And the basic problem is, and the thing that confused people for decades in thinking about the origin of life, is that everything depends on everything else. Right? You need nucleic acids to code for proteins and to help in their synthesis in many different ways. And you need both RNA and proteins to allow the DNA, cellular DNA, to be replicated. You also need RNA to help processing RNA and proteins to help process proteins. And so getting a complicated set of interdependencies like this going was, for many years, a fundamental problem. To a large extent, that was resolved by the discovery over 20 years ago of the catalytic activities of nucleic acids by Jack and Altman and Pace. So that led immediately to a much simpler conceptual model for what a very simple cell might look like. There were actually people who proposed models like this as far back as the 60s, but nobody really took them seriously in the absence of the chemical and biochemical evidence that molecules like RNA actually could be catalysts and in principle could catalyze their own replication, although that still has to be fully demonstrated experimentally. But the idea is that you could just have one class of macromolecules that can encode information They can encode it in a way that's heritable, that allows for variation to be transmitted from generation to generation, and in a way that allows that information to be expressed in a way that can confer advantageous properties on the cell as a whole. Okay. All right, so it's a big simplification. And then the question, of course, is, you know, how do you get from some kind of prebiotic chemistry to something, some kind of system like this, which is still fairly complicated? Okay. And so this is kind of a gross oversimplification and summary of many decades of work, but basically what we want to know is how to go from very small molecules, which are, you know, abundant in the universe, through a series of self-assembly chemical reactions to generate the classes of building blocks that make up biological structures. And then once you have these, they have to come together to make yet more complicated molecules, which can eventually assemble into polymers, lipids self-assemble into vesicles, amino acids into peptides, and then somehow these things all come together, magically generating a protocell, which matches up pretty much with the earlier model that we had. We need some kind of genetic component that can replicate, and some kind of additional structure that defines the cell, keeps molecules inside together, stops them from floating around. Okay. So hopefully we'll hear...
When you say RNA
or don't control genes? No. I guess some people maybe did, but I think people with a more biological origin were always thinking in terms of how you got to a cell, which has to have, you know, some structure, membranes, as well as nucleic acids. So the problems here are, at this point, not so much in terms of synthesis. There are still some synthetic steps that where there's a lot of work to be done. But the bigger problems really are how you take how you avoid having these molecules react and generate huge, complicated, horrible mixtures of hundreds or thousands of compounds in which the ones you want are a vanishingly small proportion. And that kind of channeling of chemical reactivity is, I think, the central problem now in prebiotic chemistry. But that's not what I'm going to talk about for the rest of the time. I want to talk about how we can, if we had those building blocks, and we could make membranes and polymers, what would we need to do to get life going? Okay. So this is the modern biological building block for nucleic acids, universally, all branches of life. And there are several things about these nucleoside triphosphates that make them very useful for biological systems. They're incredibly polar, so they're trapped inside the cell membrane. They have a low intrinsic chemical reactivity coupled with a very strong thermodynamic driving force for reaction. So chemically they're ideal for synthesizing polymers, but only under the strict control of highly evolved functional catalysts. And these properties which make these molecules so good for modern biology make them just terrible when you're trying to think about a very early primitive simple cell. What we want are things probably more like this, maybe not this exactly, but molecules that are less polar with a higher intrinsic reactivity, so they don't need such good catalysts, maybe don't need any catalysts. More permeable to membranes, so that if there is some environmental chemistry that results in the synthesis of molecules like this, they can actually get into the primitive cell without complicated proteins being required for to get them across the membrane. Now these kinds of molecules, these phosphoramidazolites, have been studied for the last 20 or 30 years by Leslie Orgel and many of his colleagues as model systems for non-enzymatic nucleic acid synthesis. And these are the starting points for some of the chemistry that we're doing now in trying to extend that towards a complete spontaneous system for nucleic acid synthesis. Okay, so if we had building blocks like something like that around in the early environment, could they spontaneously assemble into polymers? And so I just want to show you that in fact there are two different possibilities. This is one of the things that we look for, or that I look for, that makes me feel like, you know, this actually might be possible when it turns out that there's multiple pathways that will get us where we need to go. So this experiment shown here by Jim Ferris, was originally started in Leslie Orgel's lab, shows that under the influence of this common clay mineral, montmorillonite, those phosphoramidazolite, those highly activated nucleotides, can spontaneously assemble into RNA polymers up to around 40 nucleotides in length, which is long enough to make molecules with quite interesting functions. Okay, and this is a very abundant clay mineral that's very widespread, even on the modern Earth. So remarkably, there's another way of getting those molecules to polymerize into long chains, and that is to just dissolve them in water. And you know, you can dissolve them in water and come back and look in a day, and not much will have happened. But if you put that solution in the freezer, and then come back and look, all of a sudden they've polymerized. It's just a really delightful thing that you can take a reaction, which, yeah. These activated nucleotides here, these potential precursors for longer polymers.
And okay.
So what happens with the polymerization is that this group is an activated leaving group, and you basically make a long chain of sugar phosphate. So the phosphate sugar, and then you attach this to the phosphate of the next one and make a long chain.
So you talked about modification.
Yeah. They're building blocks which are chemically quite similar to modern building blocks, except that they're more reactive and less polar. There are many ways to do it. It's not totally obvious as to what the best way is. And later on in the talk, I'll show you many examples of the kinds of variations on nucleic acid chemistry that people are exploring.
So far, there are
It's easy to make lots of different bases, so that's the. In these experiments, so this clay polymerization, or the polymerization when you freeze things, make ice crystals. Those presumably generate more or less random sequences. And then, so that gets you almost up to where you want to be. Now you have to think about how these sequences could be copied and the useful ones could be selected out. Okay. All right. So this, the way this freezing works is that you you make ice crystals, and then a little bit of the stuff that's dissolved ends up in a liquid phase, which is in the very small interstices between the crystals. So things are very concentrated, and that's that concentration that allows them to react when they normally wouldn't. Okay, and this is something that you can obviously imagine happening in the environment. Okay. All right. So then if you grant that we can make some random sequences, how can we think about copying them. And this is the kind of stuff that Leslie Orgel's lab has worked on for so long. I just show you a simple example from an experiment that was done in my lab, where we take a particular defined sequence. Here is this little DNA sequence, and annealed base pair to a small fragment of RNA. And then we take, again, one of these activated nucleotides. This is a activated guanosine, and incubate it with this complex, and the template strand directs the elongation of the primer by adding 1, 2, and then 3 of these molecules. Okay, as you can see, you can separate these molecules of different lengths. So here's the starting material. This band corresponds to adding the first nucleotide due to base pairing with C. This is adding the second, and then you can see a little bit of the third. So the good thing is that you can start to see this kind of copying reaction going on without any enzymes, no catalysts, right? It's just template-directed copying. The bad thing is that it's taking a couple of days to add two nucleotides. So if we want to copy some longer sequence, it's going to take a really long time and probably not be very efficient, and all the students in the lab will be upset and stop working on it. So we... Yeah, well, that's a good question. That's one of the reasons why RNA is somewhat questionable as maybe the first nucleic acid, because you have two possibilities for the linkages going to the 2' or the 3' hydroxyl. When you use this particular leaving group with the methyl group up here, the linkages are mostly correct. If you use other leaving groups, sometimes you get the wrong linkage, sometimes you get a mixture. Mixtures we usually think are not so good. You can do similar experiments where everything is DNA and you only have one choice. So you always get the right product, but the reactions are a lot slower. So again, it sort of points to one of the questions, right? How to make this kind of chemistry go faster and more accurately so we can make copies efficiently. Okay, so for quite a long time, because these spontaneous reactions were kind of slow and had this issue of making the right linkage, people in my lab and other labs were thinking, well, what the obvious solution to that problem is to take advantage of the fact that RNA can catalyze reactions and just find an RNA that will be really good at catalyzing that reaction, and then the problem will be solved. Okay. So this is kind of the state of the art, and actually has been for several years now. This is a highly schematic version of an RNA molecule, which has two main domains. It's an RNA polymerase. It uses actually the modern building blocks, the nucleoside triphosphates. And it will extend a primer up to 14 nucleotides on an RNA template. So, again, the thing that's good and impressive about this work is that this is an RNA molecule that's an RNA polymerase. The bad thing is it makes a tiny amount of product over quite a long period of time. It's very slow. The fidelity is not too bad, but actually not quite good enough to copy its full sequence accurately. If this was maybe 100 or 1,000 times better, the problem would be solved. And that may happen. People are working on it. I think it's still a viable approach. There are a lot of variations that we can explore. For example, using the more highly activated building blocks, maybe we can find an RNA that works well with those. So that's sort of one approach that may lead eventually to solving the problem of self-replication. The other approach that I'll talk about more at the end is changing the chemistry around and trying to just find a purely chemical system where replication will be taken care of. Yeah? Right, right. So one partial solution to this, the poor efficiency of this kind of catalyzed polymerization, is just to use shorter templates. In fact, we know that we can assemble active catalysts just by taking pieces of RNA that are 30, 40, 50 nucleotides long. They can spontaneously assemble with each other and make a larger catalyst. This two-domain structure is almost 200 nucleotides long, so you'd need four or five pieces. But that, you know, that might help. That might help. Certainly. Of course, you know, if we could make a polymerase that was smaller, that would also help. Okay. All right. So suppose that we get there, either with the chemical methods or by finding evolving a better catalyst. Is that enough? Is that going to give us life? By which I mean, is that going to enable Darwinian evolution? And I think the answer to that is pretty clearly no. And one way to think about that is to imagine if you had an RNA molecule that could replicate itself and it's just floating around randomly in solution. Okay, so this is an RNA replicase. Suppose you have a mutant that arises in one of the copying cycles that's much better. Faster, more accurate polymerase. Right? Just the sort of thing that Darwinian evolution ought to favor and ought to take over the population. But if everything is just free in solution, this really good polymerase is just going to bump into other molecules, use them as templates, and make copies. Okay, so it's great for everybody else, but it has no advantage for itself because it's still relying for its replication on other replicases. So you can't close that feedback loop by which encoded information that gives you an advantageous phenotype feeds back on itself and results in amplification of the sequence. So what we need to take care of that is some kind of structure, some kind of compartmentalization. And there are many ways of doing this. Okay, I'm only illustrating a way of doing it in which the nucleic acids are encapsulated inside membrane vesicles. You can get the same effect if they're on the surface of particles or replicating within some kind of network of pores and some kind of gel. Anything that restricts diffusion in the right way is sufficient. The important thing is that, say, in this case, when they're within replicating compartments, purely random processes after a few generations will give you some compartments that are populated entirely by mutants. Okay, and so now they're replicating each other, and if this is a better mutant, they'll replicate faster, more accurately, whatever, be more likely to survive. The original parental sequence will also get segregated out, and if it's not very good, you will have more lineages that end up empty. So in the end, these guys will have an advantage. So compartmentalization is the second fundamental thing that you need in addition to a molecular way of encoding information, in order to allow Darwinian evolutionary processes to get off the ground. Once you have that, I think there are a lot of interesting questions, but it's relatively trivial to imagine a further, over time, increase in complexity as the cells adapt to their environment. Okay, so how do we do this? So this model, I should say, arose out of about a year of debate, sometimes in person and mostly by email, between me and Dave Bartel and Pierluigi Luisi, who had worked for many years on the membrane aspect of this. And so I think Luisi came at it originally thinking entirely of replicating membrane compartments as being the critical aspect. And Dave and I were really coming at this problem thinking entirely of the genetic information and its replication. And I think through our discussions, we came up with this model. And having done that, I felt that we had to actually try to address this experimentally and see if we could actually build something that would illustrate this kind of process. And so that's what I've been working on for quite a while. There is just a parental sequence and some mutation, which gives you an advantageous property of the polymerase. So I'm not even going into complexities like parasites, and you know, there's a lot of other stuff you can say about this. But,
then there's not more, more high probability to have, you know, more interactions between RNA and other molecules like amino acids and so on.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah.
RNA and then,
absolutely. I mean, this is, you know, not showing the rest of what's out there in the environment, which is all that complicated prebiotic chemistry, which is presumably providing a lot of molecules which could be taken advantage of by a system such as this. Right. So one of the problems with this model, which is actually going to come up, can I just address this for a minute? No. Is that, you know, people are used to thinking of membranes as barriers, right? And if you have a lot of useful stuff out there in the environment, and you have some impermeable barrier, that seems kind of self-defeating. So that's an important question that we'll come to. So, you're looking at it too carefully. All right. So, okay. So that, this brings me to really the beginning of. So the talk on this, our approach to this problem, which is a synthetic approach. Okay. So just as chemists for decades have been trying to solve individual steps in prebiotic chemistry by actually demonstrating synthetic reactions, our approach is to say, okay, well, we're going to assume that we have certain building blocks around, and we're going to see if we can put them together and make a system which can spontaneously grow and divide, and which will include some kind of genetic polymer, something that can encode information in a heritable manner. Okay, so one of the tricky parts is that this genetic polymer, whatever it is, whether it's RNA or DNA or some other related molecule, has to be able to replicate spontaneously and then get segregated into daughter cells. And then the cell membrane also has to be something that can grow spontaneously. And so it has to be able to spontaneously absorb extra membrane-forming molecules from the environment. And then it also has to be able to divide spontaneously. And normal cells, modern cells, devote a huge amount of information and biochemical effort into catalyzing and controlling all of these steps. So what we're trying to do is see if there are simple physical and chemical mechanisms that will let us do this, at least in you know, some very basic way. Okay. Now, just one thing I want to emphasize before going further is that a system like this, just like any living system, is by definition a far from equilibrium system. There are fluxes of matter and energy through this system. There are multiple ways that you can put energy into this system. So an obvious one is the chemical energy of the highly reactive nucleotide building blocks that are going to go into the replication process. There's also energy from the phase transition as amphiphilic molecules get integrated into the growing membrane. You could think of ways of using mechanical energy to assist in the division process, and so on. So there are many ways in which both matter and energy are flowing through this kind of system. I think another important point is that this is such a stripped down, simplified model of a cell. Right? As to the extent that the cell structure and mechanisms have become simplified, they require an environment which is correspondingly more complicated. So the environment has to supply all these different forms of energy and all these different molecular building blocks. Okay, a system like this can't be autotrophic in the sense that many modern organisms can live just on water, carbon dioxide, and ammonia, for example. This is going to require a much more complicated environment. And this, I should say, there's still a big raging debate as to whether the first forms of life were in fact autotrophic, whether there were chemical cycles that arose naturally that became encapsulated and allowed simple cells to grow just from water, CO2, molecules like that. And this is really an extremely opposite model in which we have a very simple cell structure that requires very complicated building blocks to be supplied from outside. Well, that's right. Right. Well, that's most of what I'm going to be talking about for the next half hour, both the growth and the division. So I'm actually going to spend most of my time on the membrane part of this system, partly because we've made more progress thinking about that. Partly because it's more visually interesting, and partly because organic chemistry, which is the basis of the nucleic acid system, is has a lot of boring stuff that's hard to explain. So. All right. So, so the membranes. One of the beautiful things about membranes is that they are self-assembling structures. You can take really simple molecules like fatty acids, like this 14-carbon fatty acid, and just mix it up in water under the right conditions, and it'll spontaneously assemble into bilayer membranes, make big sheets, and these sheets close up, and they generate these spherical structures that you can see in the background of the photograph. What I find even more amazing is that such a simple molecule displays such different structures under only moderately different conditions. So at high pH, where all these carboxylates are ionized, the only stable aggregate form are these tiny micelles, little aggregates of less than 100 molecules. They're only 2 to 4 nanometers across, roughly spherical. This keeps the negative charges as far apart as possible. As you lower the pH and you start to protonate an increasing fraction of the carboxylates, now you can have hydrogen bonding between adjacent ionized and protonated carboxylates, bring the head groups closer together, and that gives you the stabilization of this much less curved bilayer structure. If you lower the pH too much and protonate all of these, then these go away, everything collapses into oil droplets. And these aggregate structures are also dependent on the concentration. Okay, so if things are too dilute, they just dissolve. All you have are single fatty acid molecules floating around. There's a critical concentration at which micelles can form and a higher critical concentration at which these vesicles can form. Now, these vesicles have lots of interesting properties that are very different from the membranes of modern biological cells. Okay, so modern cell membranes are made of more complicated molecules like phospholipids, cholesterol, lots of other amphiphilic molecules. And they're more stable, they're better barriers. But these very simple membranes made out of just fatty acids have really interesting properties. One thing that's kind of amusing is the fact that these spherical vesicles retain their identity as separate structures for very long periods of time. And that is shown by the fact that we've made two preps here where the vesicles are labeled with two different colored dyes. The dyes are anchored into the membrane, so they can't come out. Okay? They've been mixed, and the photograph's taken a day later. So you see that the vesicles are not—they're not fusing with each other and coming apart. They're staying as separate structures. We know from other experiments that the fatty acid molecules that make up these membranes come and go and exchange on this timescale of seconds. Okay, so from second to second, these structures are made out of different collections of individual molecules, but the structures retain their identity for weeks or months. Sort of, like our bodies on the timescale of years, as the molecules that make us up exchange with the environment over years. Another critical thing is that these membranes retain large polar molecules, like fragments of DNA and RNA. So here you see a green membrane of the vesicle, and inside this orange color is fluorescently labeled RNA. And that RNA is trapped in there forever, essentially. Okay. On the other hand, small molecules, such as sugars, amino acids, ions, can cross the membrane quite readily. And at the end, I have some data to show you that even nucleotides can cross these membranes. Okay. So, but for now, let's just think a little bit more about the self-assembly process and how these vesicles can grow spontaneously. So the self-assembly that occurs as you, say, take micelles at high pH, drop the pH, there's a series of processes that culminate in the formation of large sheets which close up to spherical vesicles. The process of self-assembly is fairly complicated, still not fully understood. There's certainly an aspect of nucleation, so probably many micelles need to come together and make a small sheet which is stable enough to continue to grow. So that gives you a lag phase. There's an autocatalytic aspect to the process, so that end products or even intermediates accelerate the rate of self-assembly. So you get this sigmoidal assembly curve with time. So it's quite an interesting process that deserves more study. The fact that there is this autocatalytic aspect to the self-assembly process made a couple people in my lab, Shelley Fujikawa, and Marty Hanchik, start thinking about that and wondering if maybe other surfaces would also accelerate the self-assembly process. And I mentioned before this common mineral is clay, not marlinite. which is interesting as a potential catalyst for nucleic acid assembly. So Marty and Shelley decided to do one of these self-assembly reactions and just see if adding a little bit of this clay would do anything. So under the right conditions, the spontaneous reaction can be made to be very slow. And if you add a pinch of clay, it goes so quickly by the time you can analyze it, the reaction's basically over. By the time you can look at it in the microscope, all you see are vesicles. So that was pretty surprising, but even nicer was when they looked at the reactions in the microscope. They could see clay particles trapped inside the vesicles that had been assembled under the influence of the mineral particles. Okay, so the mineral particles are ending up trapped inside the vesicles they helped to make. So that made us think, well, okay, so these other experiments of Ferris and Orgel show that this mineral can help to assemble RNA molecules. What if we put some RNA molecules on the surface? Would this still react? And what would it look like? So they did those experiments. And it'll be a little hard to see with all those lights on, but yeah. You can see here there's a really big vesicle. This is about 20 microns across. Lots of other vesicles inside it. Here's some clay particles. And the orange color is fluorescently labeled RNA that was adsorbed onto the surface of the clay. Okay, so this clay mineral is assembling these vesicles, getting trapped inside, and it's delivering this nucleic acid to the inside of the vesicle. Okay, so in a potential prebiotic scenario, you can think of mineral particles helping to assemble genetic polymers, helping also at the same time to assemble bilayer structures, essentially bringing together the two key components of a simple cell, the membrane and the nucleic acid. Right. So the two different aspects are very different. The clay catalyzed RNA synthesis seems to be very specific to this mineral and to certain types of it that are not well understood. Nobody knows what the catalytic sites are. Nobody knows how it works. It's not something which is general to lots of minerals. The membrane assembly is totally different. Almost any mineral surface will do this as long as there's a negative surface charge. Okay. Show you a few other pictures. So here we have this very bright ring probably represents 5 or 10 bilayer membranes that are closely opposed to each other, and there's a clay particle inside with RNA. Here's one that I really like because there's a big vesicle that has thousands of tiny vesicles inside it, presumably all assembled under the influence of these clay particles that are loaded up with RNA. So I think it's just very attractive to think of some kind of mineral particles that help to bring together, help to both make and bring together the key components. Okay. Yes. Okay, so then if we assume that, okay, we can make these structures, how can they grow? How can they grow without any biological machinery to help them to grow? And here I think the first and key experiment that convinced me that this could happen was done in the Luisi lab at the ETH in Zurich. And what they did was actually an almost heroic, incredibly tedious experiment. They used cryo-electron microscopy to measure the sizes of large numbers of vesicles where the contents are labeled. See these little dots? These are electron-dense ferritin particles. So they measured a size distribution for an initial prep of fatty acid vesicles. Or actually, in this experiment, they're phospholipid vesicles. They take these vesicles and add a huge excess of fatty acid. And then they come back and do the measurements all over again by cryo-EM. They get a new size distribution. And they, because the contents are labeled, they know they're looking only at vesicles that were there originally. They can remove from consideration any new vesicles that formed. Okay, so this clearly shows that these original vesicles have grown larger. In other words, they've incorporated some of this fatty acid into the membrane structure and the membrane's grown. Okay, so so this is great, but as an experimental system, I think it's terrible, or at least we weren't willing to go this route. We wanted a faster assay, ideally a real-time assay, so we could measure the process of growth as it was happening. And we went through a number of iterations, but I'll just show you the one that we like. And this is a fluorescence assay based on resonance energy transfer between two different dyes that are anchored into the membrane of an initial population of vesicles. So you have donor and acceptor dyes. And so you irradiate to excite the donor dye. Because these dyes are fairly close to each other on average, a large fraction of the time, resonance energy transfer excites the acceptor, and then you see fluorescence from the acceptor. Now, if the membrane grows by incorporating additional molecules, these two dyes get diluted. So on average, they're further apart from each other. The energy transfer becomes less efficient, and the fluorescence you see is from the donor predominantly. And so that you can make that into a very quantitative, accurate, reproducible, and real-time assay. So you can measure growth now on the millisecond time scale instead of having to let the process go to completion and then spend, you know, weeks looking in the electron microscope. And so just one experiment here. In this experiment, we started with a population of vesicles with a certain amount of fatty acid, added an equal amount in the form of micelles over several hours, and measured the area of the preformed dye-labeled membrane, which had increased by about 90%. Okay, so the growth can be very efficient. You can incorporate almost all of the added fatty acid if you add it slowly over time. The growth is actually a really interesting and complicated process that I could spend an hour just talking about the growth. If you add a lot of micelles quickly, there's a very rapid initial growth phase, which is stoichiometrically limited. It's limited by to about a 40% increase in area, which occurs very quickly in milliseconds. We think that's because there are electrostatic interactions between micelles and the membrane surface, and you essentially can make a monolayer coat of micelles around the surface. And those molecules transfer into the membrane relatively rapidly. By the time that's over, all the other micelles have started to aggregate and make intermediate structures, and then further transfer is much slower. So it's a kinetically complicated process. If you add micelles slowly over time, you know, you don't see those intermediates, and everything happens more slowly and more efficiently. You could get fast growth by a sort of pulsatile addition of micelles. No, actually, not under. The membranes are negatively charged on their surface, and that seems to tend to prevent them from fusing effectively. Except, I should say, if you add divalent cations, especially calcium, that can bridge those molecules and bring them much closer together, you can start to see fusion events. Which are very interesting as a way of bringing, you know, new nucleic acids into play. It's not something we've studied in great detail, though. Okay, so we can make the vesicles grow. What about division? And This is what we started with several years ago. It's a very simple way of doing it. It's very artificial. Probably nothing like this could happen on the early Earth, although there are some possibilities. The basic idea is you take big vesicles, you force them through small pores, and little vesicles come out the other end. Okay, sounds simple. In fact, nobody actually knows in detail how it happens. But I think one of the key aspects of this comes from an experiment that Shelley did, which is to label the contents, the aqueous contents of the initial large vesicles with a fluorescent dye. And she could show that you only lose the fraction of the contents that you have to lose by geometrical constraints of surface to volume. So the concentration in the smaller daughter vesicles is almost the same. And that's important because it shows that as these vesicles transit the pore, they're not being shredded into fragments of membrane and where the contents are released and equilibrate with the environment. Okay, it's probably more like the vesicle gets elongated and then daughter vesicles pinch off, almost like the biological process of cell division. We're trying to study this because we'd really like to know more about how this works. And I think I have a few slides and movies, so if there's time at the end, maybe we can come back to that if there's interest. Okay. So, Okay. So this is an excellent example of how you can use mechanical energy to drive the process of division, right? You just force them through pores and they divide. Yeah, I don't think this is a good model for prebiotic cell division. I'll come to some things which I think are more reasonable later on. You know, there are people who work on fluid flow through porous rocks and minerals, and you know, maybe there's some possibility that might have an effect, but there's also reasons for thinking not that that couldn't happen. Sorry? Well, I think we'll come back to osmotic pressure, which can be very useful in helping things to grow. And conversely, if this large vesicle, say, went into moved into a fluid of higher osmotic pressure, so it deflated, then it could divide without losing any contents, which would definitely be helpful. All right, so you can combine these things, this spontaneous growth and this division by extrusion, to do cycles of growth and division. And it's a very robust process. You can grow and divide, grow, divide. This is just size here. As long as you want. And the thing that's nice is that from generation to generation, both the aqueous contents and the surface are transmitted from parental to daughter vesicles sequentially. Okay. Yeah, it probably represents something that's a little different about the initial population, that maybe something different about its size distribution or number of lamellae or something. Yeah, after that, it stays pretty much like this. Yeah. Okay. All right, so if we had an efficiently replicating nucleic acid system that was compatible with this kind of these kinds of membranes and this kind of growth and division system, we would be ready now to combine them and to watch evolution start to happen spontaneously. Right? So it's just too bad that we don't have a replicating nucleic acid. But I think, you know, well, I'll show you ways that we're trying to get there eventually. But meanwhile, we've been also thinking about how do other approaches to this kind of growth and division cycle, and especially approaches that are more prebiotically reasonable. Okay. All right. So I'm going to tell you one little story about growth, and then show you some more recent experiments on division. And so the growth pathway that I showed you before works by having preformed vesicles and adding my cells. So my cells are at a high pH, they go into a buffered solution of vesicles at lower pH, and those my cells are then thermodynamically unstable, and that leads eventually to transfer of those molecules incorporation into the membrane. So this is a different pathway for growth that was worked out by Irene Chen, who's a really fantastic biophysics grad student in the lab. And this pathway came from thinking about osmotic pressure in these kinds of systems. And so the basic idea is that you have this semi-permeable bilayer membrane made of fatty acids. We have nucleic acids encapsulated on the inside. And since these are high molecular weight polymers, they don't by themselves contribute much to the osmotic pressure. But for charge neutralization, they're surrounded by counterions, and those counterions do contribute a substantial osmotic pressure. So if you have a high concentration of RNA on the inside, you'll have a significant internal osmotic pressure that swells the vesicle and results in the membrane being under tension. And in fact, there's a maximum, a critical tension that you can't exceed without rupturing the membrane, but you can, well, it's actually an interesting coincidence, maybe, that the concentrations of RNA that get you sort of close to that rupture tension for small vesicles are similar to the concentrations of RNA in our cells. Okay, so what we wondered is if we did this, if we looked at osmotically swollen vesicles where the membrane's under tension, what would happen? It would seem that if the membrane's under tension, that would make it more thermodynamically favorable for additional amphiphilic molecules to get incorporated into the membrane, and maybe that would help with growth. And so in this experiment, what Irene did was to put those fluorescent donor acceptor dyes into the membrane of a starting set of vesicles, in this case, the swollen vesicles. Okay, so what we're doing, in effect, is monitoring the surface area of a population of swollen vesicles. And so just if you just add buffer or add more swollen vesicles, not much happens. But if you add empty, relaxed vesicles, the surface area immediately starts to increase. Okay. You can do the converse experiment and label the relaxed vesicles, the isotonic vesicles, and they're fine by themselves, but as soon as you mix them with swollen vesicles, the surface area of these isotonic vesicles starts to decrease. Okay, so what's happening? So here's the model, schematic version of the experiment. So we have swollen vesicles under osmotic pressure, right? Membranes under tension, they're fine by themselves, totally stable, nothing happens as long as they're off by themselves. You can have empty vesicles or vesicles with less RNA, not swollen, relaxed membrane, they're also perfectly fine by themselves. As soon as you mix them together, these guys start to grow by stealing lipid molecules from these, which start to shrink until you approach equilibrium. Okay, so the significance is twofold. Okay, so first, here is a second different pathway for growth, okay, in which the feedstock is basically empty vesicles, and vesicles that are populated by nucleic acids can grow at the expense of those empty vesicles. The probably more interesting implication is that if these nucleic acids were self-replicating nucleic acids, then anything, any mutation, any sequence variant that was better at replication, that would replicate faster, would grow faster. Right? It would replicate, increase its concentration. That increasing concentration would drive membrane growth at the expense of its neighbors with less efficient replication. So, from this very simple physical principle, we have right off the bat a coupling between the replication of the genetic material and the replication of the cell membrane. And this is exactly the kind of thing that we're looking for in all of these experiments, simple physical principles that help us to understand how early cells could form and how evolutionary principles could start to come into play. Okay, any questions about this experiment before I go on? All right. So the fatty acids come and go on the second time scale. They're very dynamic. Well, yeah, we don't actually know. You know, they come into solution. In solution, there may be single molecules, micelles. Yeah, all the details of the transfer are not really clear at this point. Yeah, so there's a lot to do to understand this in more detail, for sure. That's a good question. we don't. And part of the reason is these experiments were mostly done with very small vesicles on the order of 100 nanometers. We're not really good at cryo-EM, so you know, we haven't been able to do that. You know, light scattering is, I'm always take it with a grain of salt, and you know, the population size distributions that you get from light scattering experiments are so model dependent, it's hard to take it too seriously. So we don't have good information. It's an interesting question as to whether the size distributions would stay homogeneous or diverge. To a large extent, that's also controlled by the division pathway, and so in this model, we're imagining that the division is either just a stochastic process or maybe a threshold. If it was extrusion, there would be a size threshold that would drive division and maintain a more or less homogeneous population. But if there was some other stochastic process, the population could become very heterogeneous. And then, of course, because the membrane tension is a function of the vesicle radius as well as the internal pressure, then you know that starts to make it really complicated. So, I mean, we absolutely need to have some kind of replication system so that we can, you know, so we can show that, so we can demonstrate the evolutionary implication. And I mean, at the moment, we're limited to a 25 or 30% change in area, right? Because the system just approaches equilibrium and then that's the end. Right? So we need to have a way of continuously driving replication of the internal material. Okay, so a lot of the issues that were just brought up in terms of size distribution and division mechanisms are all problematic in those experiments because you can't just look at the vesicles and see what's happening. And so for a long time, I was very reluctant to work with larger vesicles that you can see in the microscope because they're much more heterogeneous systems. Very difficult to make uniform size populations. They all have, all these larger vesicles have complicated internal structures that are very messy. But anyway, fortunately, the students in the lab ignored me and went on and did the experiments anyway. So a lot of this work is done by Ting Zhu, who's a really terrific HST student. And he worked out some ways of making relatively uniform vesicles that are in the size range of about 4 microns. And those are what you'll see in a lot of the subsequent pictures and movies. Okay. So one of the One of the early bizarre things that Ting noticed was this phenomenon. So these vesicles, I should explain first, are loaded up with fluorescent dyes in their internal aqueous spaces. And the picture is overexposed, so you can't really see much. But if you just look at these under very bright illumination, you see a really amazing thing happen. I can get this to play. Okay, so these vesicles have smaller internal vesicles, just like in the pictures I showed earlier. And he was just looking at them in a microscope, and he saw these vesicles exploding and releasing their internal contents. So what's going on? What we think is happening is that there is some photochemistry that results from the illumination of the dye molecules that results in reactive oxygen species, which react with the buffer in this system and increase the internal osmotic pressure inside the vesicle to the point that the outer membrane ruptures and the inner smaller vesicles are released. Okay. So, okay, not very prebiotic, but it made us start thinking about mechanisms in which compound vesicles, large vesicles with smaller vesicles inside, might rupture, release small baby vesicles that could then grow again into large compound vesicles. And if you could repeat that cycle, you'd have a very nice method for propagation. And so we also wanted to think if there might be simpler ways of doing this. And so the next little movie, if we can get to it, shows the obvious trick, which is to use changes in osmotic pressure. Okay, so if the vesicle moves into a region of lower osmotic pressure, it's the largest outer membrane will rupture first, and the contents will be released. And so in this movie, what you're going to see are this vesicle and another one will come in. They're in a little microfluidic device. They go up this way into a region of lower osmotic strength and rupture and release their contents. Okay, so you can imagine a prebiotic pool, it's raining, there's regions of lower osmotic pressure, and then internal baby vesicles get released. Okay, so that seems like very nice. It's not really division, but it releases small internal contents. And if those internal vesicles can grow and make compound vesicles again, then there's a nice system. Yeah. Yeah. Well, so this is an aspect of the self-assembly of these vesicles that is completely confusing at this point. We've been using video microscopy to try to watch the self-assembly process. You can start from dried films, and then you add water, and you watch vesicles form. And we can see the whole process. Tubules form, and they go through all kinds of crazy intermediates, and in the end, you end up with vesicles that have internal vesicles, and we still can't figure out exactly what's happening. I mean, there's all kinds of interesting transformations that are going on, but it's a series of non-obvious steps. I wish I could explain exactly how it's happening, but we haven't really figured that out. It does happen. Well, so there's all kinds of conceptually easy experiments, right, where you label the outer membrane and try to watch, does the stuff inside get the label, all kinds of pulse labeling experiments to do. I mean, I think it's an experimentally tractable system, but at this point, all we can say is that it happens, and we don't know how.
More
Right, right. As far as we can tell, it doesn't happen. These vesicles don't like to fuse with each other. Yeah, even when they're really held packed together. Well, I guess, you know, in that case, I can't really say. Yeah, we also need to know when these internal vesicles form. Are they just encapsulating a sample of the internal space, or is what's inside them, you know, have to get filtered through the membrane? There are a lot of important questions. That's a good question. I don't know. I have to go back and look at the pictures more carefully. Yeah. The reason, I think, is that you're only looking at the contents. We're not looking at the membrane in this movie. So we're trying to. Right. It's different. Right. Now, in the first one, when I first saw it, I thought that maybe the membrane really was really exploding, and then those fragments were quickly closing up and capturing some of the fluid. So we need to do these where we're not looking just at the contents, but where we're looking at the membrane. I think that'll clarify a lot of these issues. Okay, good. All right, so let's see. Okay, so then Ting decided to look at growth of these large vesicles. And I don't know, can we turn down the lights? Because I don't think you're going to be able to see some of this very well. Oh, great, thanks. So here we have some of these initial vesicles. They're around 4 microns. And then you just add micelles, just like in the earlier experiments. And we expected to just sort of see them get bigger. Maybe if the, you know, the volume increased more slowly, maybe we'd see prolate, ellipsoid shapes or something. But in fact, what we saw are these little tails growing out of the spherical vesicles. And over time, the tails get longer. And the spherical part gets smaller, and eventually they make just these huge, huge long thread-like structures. So this was not what we expected at all. This is not something, this formation of these little tails budding out of spheres, this is not on any of the shape phase diagrams that you'll see from studies of, you know, vesicle shapes under different conditions. This is completely unexpected. We don't know why this happens. We don't know, you know, what's going on in the membrane there. They're tubes. What you're looking at, again, is a fluorescent dye in the aqueous contents. We haven't done this yet, looking at the membrane. I can show that these long tubes are still vesicles, in a sense, because the process is reversible. And let's see, there we go. So if you illuminate with bright light again, you have this osmotic swelling as a result of this photochemistry, and the tubes contract and go right back to spheres. we're looking, the condition is the illumination intensity is increased. And, right, presumably because you're having photochemistry from reactive oxygen species from the fluorescent dye, and then that there are chemical reactions with the buffer. We can actually see oxidized derivatives of the buffer in sort of model experiments with mass spec. Okay, so anyway, you know, bizarre as it is, the point is that you go from spherical vesicles to these long thread-like structures, and they're still continuous vesicle structures. They're just highly elongated. Okay, now, but that's, these threads are really interesting and useful because they provide other opportunities for pathways for division. And the simplest one is that these long, so looking at more close up at one of these long thread-like structures, they're very delicate and very slight flows in the surrounding fluid will lead to effectively to division. You can also see in this, you'll see in this movie something that is seen quite, I don't know, commonly, but there are a number of papers on this purling instability where a long thread-like vesicle transforms into a series of beads that are linked by tethers. It's quite dramatic visually. Okay, so you can see the purling instability here, these bead-like structures, and then at some point it snaps and you release fragments. Okay, so if all of this is happening in an environment where there's some turbulent flow, then obviously you get, in fact, you do get very good division. Yeah, well, that's a very, very interesting question, yeah. So we haven't tried to do this where the vesicles start off highly swollen. So it'd be very interesting to see if that suppresses the formation of the thread-like, initiation of those thread-like structures, yeah. Okay, so let me show you one more bizarre thing. Maybe not advance. Okay. All right. So this is more photochemically induced events, and you know, and again, I should say we don't really understand the chemistry behind this very much, but it's sort of giving us new things to think about in terms of processes that might be relevant. And so here we start off looking at one of these thread-like vesicles. So this is after growth by adding micelles. Here's a particularly dramatic example of the purling instability, and you can see, in some cases, you can see some of these little bead-like structures are actually, they're all linked by very fine membrane tethers. And the reversibility shows it's they're still, it's all continuous up to this point. But then on further, you're just watching it, again under high light intensity, the tethers seem to fall apart or get disrupted somehow. And then all of the little beads are released as separate structures that start to float away from each other. And so that's obviously another very interesting potential pathway for division that we'd like to understand better and explore. So I show you that as a movie. So, you know, this is, I sort of have to apologize because this is just a huge amount of phenomenology and we know almost nothing about what's going on in these systems. But I think it just shows that, I mean, these are all just simple fatty acids and there's so much to learn about the behavior of structures that are made from these simple molecules. Okay. All right, so that's about where we are in terms of looking for pathways of growth and division. So there's a lot to do in terms of understanding the underlying physical transformations, which I think is very important, but in parallel with that, we're trying to push ahead on the nucleic acid front and come up with some kind of chemical system that will allow for particular sequences to be copied reasonably accurately and rapidly. And so the approach that we're taking here is to sort of step away from this effort to evolve catalysts of replication. It's partly because we've gotten kind of tired of it after 20 years. And just see if we can play around with the chemistry, make changes in the backbone structure, changes with the sugars and some of the atoms. So here's standard DNA. This sugar, which you can see is slightly different, it's missing this carbon, is called TNA. This is 3-O's nucleic acid. This is a structure that was first synthesized by the Eschenmoser group. It's prebiotically somewhat interesting because it's a 4-carbon sugar that you can imagine being assembled in one step from two carbon precursors. It's physically interesting because this polymer can base pair with itself and with DNA and RNA, even though the backbone repeat unit here is one atom and one bond shorter. So that was that was a big surprise. Here are a couple of examples of acyclic sugars. This one we are studying because it's so structurally simple. Here the carbon backbone, the sugar, is basically just 3 carbons. It's glycerol. And the backbone goes through these 2 hydroxyls, and the nucleobases are attached to this carbon. It's synthetically very accessible. The backbone is very much more flexible, and yet it's still a good base pairing system. It's remarkable. It base pairs with itself. In this case, it base pairs with itself much better than it base pairs with DNA. Now, that sort of gives you an idea of the fact that there's a big chemical space to play with while retaining the ability to have Watson-Crick base pairing and therefore to encode and in principle to transmit information by copying. So the important thing though is to find ways of making the spontaneous copying reaction go faster. And so one simple thing that you can do is replace the oxygen here with the nitrogen. Okay, so that means in the building block, instead of a hydroxyl, you have an amino group, which is a much better nucleophile, much more reactive chemical group. And that can give you 2 or 3 orders of magnitude increase in reaction rates. You combine that with the increase in reaction rates that you get with using these different leaving groups. And now you're in a range where replication reactions, where addition reactions go in minutes instead of years. Okay. So I don't want to take too long going through all of the chemistry, but just show you one example from the polymer that we started playing around with, which is phosphoramidate DNA. So this is basically regular DNA except for this change of one oxygen to a nitrogen. Here's the building block, an amino group instead of a hydroxyl. We're using this highly activated form. And so we thought that with these 2 chemical changes, it should put us in a range where the copying reaction is extremely fast. And in fact, if you look at a single step, that's true. Okay, so in this experiment, we have a template and a primer. The primer ends either in a normal base or an amino base, and we look for the addition of one extra G, one of these building blocks. Now, what we're adding is actually, in this case, not the amino nucleotide, just a regular nucleotide, so the addition stops here. Adding on to the hydroxyl is very slow. So when the primer has a regular DNA base with the 3' hydroxyl, you add this activated building block and look a day later, nothing's happened. It's still very slow, even with the better leaving group. If the primer ends in an amino group, you can come back in a couple of minutes and everything is transformed into product. So we thought, wow, that's fantastic. You know, we can add every nucleotide we can add in a minute or a few minutes. We'll be copying things 50 long in a few hours. It's great. As soon as we went to trying to get multiple additions, we ran into problems. One of the problems is very easy to understand, and that is that you have a reactive nucleophile very close to a reactive electrophile. And of course, this building block starts to cyclize and generate an unreactive side product. And as soon as that reaction goes to completion, everything stops. Okay, so that part we understand, that's fine. That gives you some limitation. There's something else which is very mysterious that we don't understand, which I think, well, let me see. I'll come to it in another slide. Having that single base addition reaction allowed us to try an interesting experiment, however, and that's to start combining this system with these fatty acid vesicles. So in this experiment, we put the primer template on the inside of a vesicle. We add the reactive building block on the outside, let it diffuse in, and monitor the formation of the product where the primer has grown by adding one base. And so let's see. So over here is the solution reaction. Here's reactions in the vesicle. They both go to completion. Okay, so that's very good for the initial model that I showed you, where we have activated nucleotides on the outside. They diffuse in. You start to see replication chemistry going on the inside. So far, so good. You start to try to iterate that process and have multiple additions, okay, using our aminonucleotide, then the good news is that we do see some growth. So here we see the primer being extended up to a little bit of plus six product. Here's the solution control, so no vesicles. You see more growth, but you also see something very strange, which is that most of the primer doesn't react at all. Some of it goes up to plus 10. This is a kind of processivity that you expect to see from an enzymatic reaction, right, where a limiting amount of enzyme binds to some substrate and does the reaction, and then it has to come back and do more. But there's no enzyme here. We have no idea why this reaction looks so processive. We have some not very good models. Whatever's going on there, leading to the fact that most of the primer doesn't react at all, it's a big limitation. Okay. So what do we, let's see, let me go back here. So that was our sort of first generation attempt. So it shows you that the replication chemistry can be increased in rate dramatically, but there are still, we need another 100-fold. We need to solve those problems. So the first problem is this cyclization, actually. The cyclization is a major limitation, and that can be easily solved by looking at some of the other variant nucleic acids that I showed you. So one solution is to move the amino group here over to this position on the sugar. Now it's geometrically impossible for it to react with this phosphate. And in fact, we've made those molecules, they don't cyclize. And in the very first preliminary experiments, it looks like we get a lot more of the desired extended primer. Whatever the other factor is that results in this sort of apparently processive chemistry and some of the primers not reacting, that's still happening, so we don't understand that. So we're just now scaling up after months of work to look at to have all of these aminonucleotides with the amino group in the 2 position. We'll be able to explore that chemistry in great detail, and it might be good enough, it might not. There are lots of other variants of the structure that can be explored that we're starting to synthesize. The problem is simply one of organic chemistry. It takes at least several months to make the building blocks for every new system that you want to study. So that's required kind of a major transformation of my lab into a synthesis lab, which took a while. But we're doing it, and I think we'll be able to explore all of these different chemistries and hopefully eventually come up with something where we can replicate polymers of reasonable length, meaning say 30 to 50 in a reasonable time frame. Okay. Now, I think somewhere early on, the issue came up of getting these things across the membrane. So in these experiments, you can see that these will cross the membrane. You can see here that it's not very efficient because there's a lot less product here in these vesicle reactions than in the solution. So it's kind of slow. This experiment was done at room temperature, and for a long time, we were shackled by the idea that these fatty acid vesicles were very delicate structures because they didn't have these nice, robust phospholipids, right? We were afraid to do anything like heat them up. But in fact, it turns out you can heat them to over 90 degrees. They're perfectly fine. They're very stable structures. And amazingly, at 90 degrees, nucleotides equilibrate across this membrane in minutes. And larger polymers are still trapped inside. Okay, so there's just a bunch of time courses. So the red line is 90 degrees, and it's roughly half done in 5 minutes. So they're very permeable, even to nucleotides at elevated temperatures. The vesicles are not falling apart at the high temperature because they retain a tenmer indefinitely. And so we think this is very nice. It essentially solves two problems. First of all, we can get nucleotides in easily, efficiently. And also, it means that we can do thermocycling types of experiments, right? We can raise the temperature so that double-stranded products can dissociate. Nucleotides come in, then we drop the temperature, copying can occur, and then the double-stranded products can again be separated in the next high temperature phase. Okay. All right, so just to summarize everything, it looks like at this point we have now multiple pathways for both growth and division. So what initially seemed like a huge problem, getting growth and division to happen without any biological machinery, turns out to have multiple solutions. We can get building blocks into the vesicles, and they're more stable than we thought. We're just at the beginning of starting to see replication reactions happen on the inside of these vesicles. I didn't have time to tell you about some experiments where we do put catalytically active RNAs on the inside, and we can show they're still active. So if we or someone else does get an RNA replicase, in fact, we can put it on the inside of these vesicles, and it'll be fine. And we have a lot of chemistry to do, but this chemical approach to nucleic acid replication looks promising. And so from all of that, what have we really learned? So I think, to me, the most interesting and important aspect of all of this work is that a very simple but unexpected physical phenomena turn out to play really important potential roles. They can lead to all kinds of surprising results that I think would be very hard to anticipate just by thinking about it. It's only when you're actually doing these experiments that you actually can get to some of these solutions. So one thing I talked about was this role of osmotic pressure driving vesicle growth. Another experiment I didn't have time to go into, it came again from looking at the transport of small molecules across these membranes. It turns out, for reasons that still aren't entirely clear, that ribose is much more permeable to these membranes than any of its diastereomeric relatives. So you can make genetic polymers with arabinose or lixose or xylose, but those sugars cross the membrane much more slowly. So that means that an early simple cell that used ribose as a substrate would have had a big advantage. It might be one contributing factor towards why ribose is used in our genetic polymers. Talked about the role of mineral particles. Another thing I think that's really interesting that's come out of this is to think of the ways that energy is dissipated in these systems. So for example, we can start off with activated nucleotides, with where you have a lot of chemical energy in the structure of that of those compounds. They diffuse in and in principle can polymerize and make polymers that are trapped on the inside, which increases the internal osmotic pressure, right? So some of that chemical energy has in effect been transduced into the energy of that internal osmotic pressure. And then that osmotic pressure is used to drive membrane growth. And then there's a series of other subsequent phenomena, including the formation of pH and ion gradients, which inevitably follow from the growth of membranes in these systems. And so you can sort of trace a pathway in which some of the initial chemical energy from the nucleotides ends up in the membrane system and even in ion gradients. So I think that's a really interesting thing that will be important as these systems continue to get developed. Okay, so just want to end by saying again that this work has really depended on a lot of fantastic people in the lab. I've tried to mention some of them as I went along, especially Shelley and Marty and Irene, the permeability work by Sharif Manzi, and the vesicle movies by Ting Zhu. And a lot of the chemistry has been driven by Doug Trico and some of these people. And thank you for your attention. Yeah.
I was mentioned about your early part of this talk, where you talked about a clay serving as a possible template for regurgitation of RNA.
Yeah.
Is there any hypothetical mechanism by which the information could be stored in clay and transferred to the regurgitation? I mean, the gate, yeah. So they're talking about some.
Right. I mean, the trouble is we don't even understand the mechanism by which this polymerization occurs. No one knows whether, you know, the particular ions that are trapped in the clay lattice that make reactive sites, or is it, you know, edge or defect structures. You know, there's just almost nothing about what's going on there.
Right.
Well, you know, it's checked to the extent that you can, and in terms of, you know, dye and maybe even trinucleotide abundances are, you know, look like more or less what you'd have from a random sequence. I mean, there is a question of whether this surface or some other surfaces could be important in catalyzing templated replication, which, you know, would be even more interesting. And no one's been able to demonstrate that yet. It would be great if there was some, you know, mineral surface that would, you know, give us even some modest catalysis of templated replication. Yeah, yes. I didn't go into that in detail. So in fact, some of the experiments that I showed you, well, most of them are done with pure individual fatty acids. But if you make mixtures of a fatty acid with the corresponding alcohol or glycerol ester, those membranes become simultaneously more physically robust and stable over greater pH ranges, and also more permeable to small molecules. And so we're actually doing a lot of lipid chemistry now to try to understand that. Now, part of it comes from thinking of models for how does a molecule like a nucleotide actually get across a hydrophobic barrier like a bilayer membrane. Right? So the most reasonable model is that the polar molecule is essentially becomes solvated by the head groups of the fatty acids and the other molecules that are in there. And that if those can favor a highly curved surface, you can essentially make a defect structure that sort of goes in so that the polar molecule is always interacting with head groups. It never has to actually go into the hydrophobic part of the membrane, right? And then it just sort of comes out the other side. So we're trying to look at head groups of different sizes, and it does look like things that favor high curvature favor permeability. So there's a lot to do with the membrane, with the lipid chemistry.
Okay, one more second. Yep. In the lipid world, you have atypical composition, which is just the right composition for what you just mentioned. Perhaps you want to find mechanisms by which this composition will get propagated.
Yeah. Right. So the trouble is, I find it very hard to imagine how that can happen at the level of fatty acids and similar molecules, because they're just constantly exchanging with the environment. Everything gets homogenized, right? If you put in some vesicles made from 10 carbon fatty acids and some made from 14, and you mix them together, within a few seconds, everything's all mixed up. But when you get to the point of having, structures that are more like phospholipids that essentially don't exchange, now you're at a level where you can, if there's an advantageous composition and that can be controlled and synthesized, then that can propagate. The trouble is you have to go through some intermediate steps, because before you have cells that have phospholipid boundaries, you have to build up all of the machinery that allows you to live inside such a good boundary, which means permeases and ion channels, and not to mention the synthetic machinery to make those molecules. So there's probably a lot of steps in between these simple fatty acid membranes and membranes of more controlled composition. Right, well, I think that is one of the major lessons that's come from the chemistry of probably largely Eschenmoser and some other groups like Benner and Hirschwein, that there are a lot of nucleic acid structures that look like they would be perfectly good genetic systems. Right? They have good base pairing. Some of them are, they can be kind of grouped into families of molecules which can all base pair with each other. So you could imagine transmitting information from one structure to another. Right, so if you started off, say, with glycerol nucleic acid, you could transmit information into RNA or DNA by base pairing. There are others, like peranacyl RNA, which make a perfectly fine base pairing system, but they're totally incompatible. Their structure is different enough. The helical parameters are different enough that you can't transfer information from one to another. So I think our nucleic acids have kind of lost that sense of uniqueness, right, that we had for a long time. They look like just one of many possible solutions. Now, which leads, of course, immediately to the question of why do we have the ones that we have? Right? So there's the stability. DNA and RNA are just about as far apart as you can get in terms of their chemical stability, which, probably makes sense. You want something really stable for archiving information, and you want something really unstable for molecules that you want to turn over and, use for one thing and then 2 minutes later for something else. Right. The phosphoramidate nucleic acids are chemically relatively stable. whereas RNA falls apart in alkali, these fall apart in acid. In terms of another important stability question is the stability of the double helical structure, right? And DNA is kind of nice. It's the duplex structure is stable enough, but you can separate the strands just thermally. RNA, in fact, is probably too stable. Once you get above a certain length, you cannot thermally separate the strands. You start to need enzymatic machinery to do it. And some of these other polymers suffer from this duplex stability problem. Some are too weak, some are too strong. We probably need to start with something that can be thermally separated or separated easily in some other way. Another factor that's really important is the stability of the monomers, right? If the activated monomer reacts with itself, makes, for example, this cyclic byproduct, that's really bad. That makes it look like that polymer's not a good starting point. So the cyclic sugars that we have in RNA and DNA are great because they minimize that byproduct chemistry. So I think all of these other considerations start to come into play.
Thank you.